Good morning and welcome to episode 22 of our Employment Q&A Ask the Experts with the employment team at Sinton's here. Thank you again for all your positive comments, for signing up, tuning in, listening to the podcast afterwards and watching the videos online. And thank you for sending your questions in. As always, we're going to be covering three topics, questions. I'm joined today by Keith Land, the head of our department, and I'm Catherine Hope, an associate in the department, so we'll be covering those three questions. I kind of think in this situation, we maybe should have been looking at, given the news today, intra-office relationships, but we have got three questions that will, we've stayed away from COVID this week, so we've got three questions that came in that are of interest, and I'll be covering the first and third, and Keith will be covering the second. So without any further ado, I'll start with the first question. This is one that came in this week, and it's quite an interesting one. It's the question about if you're going through a grievance procedure and you've carried out that, your investigation, you've had various meetings with individuals, you've got witness statements, you've collected various documentation, and you may well have then had your, as you might ordinarily do, you produce a report, and then you would give an outcome to the employee who's raised the grievance, setting out your findings and how you've come to those. In this situation, does the employee have the right to see that documentation, whether that be the report or the actual statements and documentation themselves? That was a question that came in this week. I guess the starting point in this is the ACAS code doesn't give a specific right. It's unlike disciplinary proceedings, whereby if someone is invited to a formal disciplinary hearing, it's fundamental that they're given copies of all the evidence that you as the employer will rely on in reaching your decision. So it's different in that respect, but it's not prohibited. So it may well be something you decide to do. You can see why an employee might ask to see that. A report that you put together, it shows the investigation you've carried out and it shows how you've come to conclusions you have done. So it's entirely reasonable and you may well expect an employee to ask to see that. So it's a choice for you to make. I think it may well be something you decide to do if it's raised. I guess if you are, you need to really think about what's in that report, what's in that documentation in terms of duties, in terms of confidentiality, but also data protection legislation. You'll need to carry out that balancing exercise and looking at individual rights in terms of people who are identified in that and the information that is set out in that documentation, and balancing that against the requirement to be transparent and clear. And in terms of complying with data protection, it may well be appropriate in certain circumstances to redact documentation if you're then going to give it to the employee to make sure you're complying with your data protection obligations. So the position is you can do that if you want to. Obviously, the ACAS guidance, which isn't the statutory code, it does remind us of the fact that obviously that employees can make data subject access requests in relation to information where they themselves are mentioned in that, they're named. But obviously that doesn't give them the right to see then that private information relating to other individuals. So it's something for you to decide and make that decision as employer on a case-by-case basis. What I would say is, I guess, from a practical perspective, is think about the potential of further antagonising an employee or causing further distrust when you have an employee who's probably aggrieved, obviously, given they've raised a grievance at that stage. So that's something certainly to think about. So that's the first question. I'll pass you on to Keith now to cover the second topic.
Thanks, Catherine. I hope I've just unmuted because I've left my mouse at home, so I'm working on the keyboard. But hopefully you can all hear me. Second question, really, maternity rights and premature birth. Well, we normally try and be really positive in what we're doing, but this is unfortunately one of those questions which is very sad. A question arose in relation to a tragic case where an employee has lost a child mid-pregnancy. So really tragic, but it's something that could crop up and it's one of those situations that's difficult because of the circumstances involved at the time. So where do we start? Well, look, let's start with maternity leave and maternity rights. I think we're all pretty familiar with them nowadays because they've been around for a long time. What are the basic rights for a woman that's pregnant? Well, time off for antenatal appointments, 52 weeks maternity leave, irrespective of her length of service. statutory maternity pay for 39 weeks, 6 weeks at 9/10, and then 33 weeks at the government flat rate. The right to share leave and pay nowadays, that's a whole topic in itself. The right to return to work following maternity leave, right for priority in a redundancy situation for alternative employment, some rights to flexibility on return, and protection from dismissal and detriment. I'm sure we're all familiar with the framework. One of the key concepts, the expected week of childbirth, which is effectively a lot of the rights run from the timings of when a woman is due to have the child, which when she's predicted to have the child, because it clearly is not that formulaic. This is driven by the MAT B1 certificate, which an employee can get from the midwife and which an employer can ask for too. And it's basically when it's a certificate which predicts the date when a woman is due to have the baby. Okay. To qualify for maternity leave, an employee should ordinarily notify the employer no later than the 15th week before the expected week of pregnancy that she's pregnant and she's going to take maternity leave. That triggers rights like maternity leave. But what happens if there's a premature birth, or indeed what happens in the tragic case where there's a stillbirth, or where a baby is born, lives for a very short period of time, and then tragically passes away? In this really sad example, or the question posed, a woman went into hospital around 24 weeks of gestation. That's not 24 weeks prior to the expected week of childbirth. That's 24 weeks into the pregnancy. She had the child in that week. The baby was so premature it went into intensive care and tragically passed away about 3 weeks later. And so the question posed is, what rights are triggered for the woman in these circumstances when she's had that really awful life event? Well, the short answer is, if the baby is born alive, irrespective of the period of child of pregnancy, and that is if they live for 1 second or 3 weeks or 2 days, all the maternity rights apply from the day after the date of birth. There are then different rules, unfortunately, if there is a stillbirth. If a stillbirth occurs before the 24th week of the pregnancy, unfortunately, the rules are such that that is not classed as childbirth. Therefore, the woman doesn't qualify for maternity rights, doesn't qualify for maternity pay. Her absence will be pregnancy-related absence, but it will just be treated by you under your normal sickness absence policies. That changes again if the woman has a stillbirth after 24 weeks into gestation. In that instance, all maternity rights apply from the day after birth. Maternity leave is such that it is assumed that a woman will take the full period of ordinary maternity leave and additional maternity leave, and so she will be off for 52 weeks. There is clearly a period of 2 weeks compulsory leave where no work can be done, and then the balance of the maternity leave applies. And it's assumed it will be the maximum length, unless a woman decides to curtail that for whatever reason on 8 weeks prior notice. A couple of sort of practical issues. Naturally, I'm sure any employer who has an employee that's faced with this awful circumstance will have the greatest degree of sympathy. But a word of warning for the wise. You'll recall probably from previous discussions and podcasts that maternity rights and maternity leave is such that it can't be broken except for keeping in touch days. And so you might want to rush into saying, well, OK, you're off on sick leave. And that will be the natural reaction for most employers, I'm sure, because they'll want to do the right thing. But it's a time to take a pause of breath, speak with the employee and discuss things. The maternity leave periods, if they apply, are automatically triggered, and you don't want to suddenly write to somebody and say, right, well, you're on sick leave, because at that point in time, you may in an inadvertently interrupt their period of maternity leave, and you might not want to do that until you've had some kind of discourse with the employee. Obviously, maternity pay will trigger automatically again on the birth. Again, in some respects, that is 9/10 of normal earnings, and you might think, well, actually, I don't want to interrupt a poor woman when they've had this tragic life event. An employer can always choose to top up to 100% of pay. All you'll be paying in that instance is the additional 10% for the first 6 weeks. And so there is some time and space to preserve a woman's maternity rights and do the right thing. The last point I would raise is we have this new right of bereavement leave and pay. The death of a child under 18 or a stillbirth after 24 weeks into gestation and pregnancy, but not before, triggers this right to bereavement leave, where a woman and a man, to be perfectly honest with you, can give notification to their employer that they're going to take 2 weeks bereavement leave. That can be taken any time up to 56 weeks from the date of the death or the stillbirth. Once again, word of warning, if you're trying to supplement somebody's earnings in these circumstances, you can't break a period of maternity leave to send somebody off on bereavement leave. You would have to wait, and they could structure that along with their holidays at the end of whatever period of maternity leave they wanted to take. Meant to be a 2-minute whistle stop, but it's one of those areas which is complex. There are funny rules that apply and don't apply. Hopefully I've clarified them for you. And I'm going to pass you back to Catherine, who's going to deal with the last question. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Keith. Right, the last question, it's about settlement agreements. So say you've entered into a settlement agreement, so that's a legally binding contract you can use, to settle certain statutory claims, such as unfair dismissal, discrimination. It's a contract that's used in that specific situation, and it's often used relating to the termination of an employee's employment. So say you've entered one of those, but actually for one reason or another, you end up re-engaging that employee. What are the risks there? I think the starting point here is to confirm there's no specific, it's not prohibited for actually re-employing someone. And what you'd need to check, I guess, as you always would need to, is looking at any contractual restrictions, whether that be in the contract of employment, the settlement agreement, but also from a regulatory perspective, anything in a from a sector-specific point of view that would restrict anything in that regard. Practical considerations, what's the reason for the termination, is always going to be relevant in terms of considering whether re-engagement is actually appropriate. But again, it would also be relevant when looking at, is it possible? I imagine there are certain circumstances where, from a regulatory perspective, again, in certain sectors, re-engagement is not possible because of the particular reason for the termination in the first place. Tax implications, if you'd given an ex gratia payment under that settlement agreement, for example, up to £30,000 that can be paid tax-free as compensation for termination of employment, there may be some implications there. From a redundancy perspective, in terms of redundancy payment, simply re-engaging someone in itself shouldn't necessarily affect the tax status of a redundancy, statutory redundancy payment, which is paid tax-free. But you need to be aware that HMRC might look into that, and if there are, if a job is on the same terms and there's no general obvious commercial reason why for the re-engagement, for example, there's not been a clear variation in the situation and the need for work, it may well be that they would question the validity of the termination and re-engagement in the first place. And it might be that they would look in terms of the underlying situation, and they might decide actually, it wasn't justified that there was a redundancy payment made, and also that any payment was made is to be classed as earnings and therefore taxed. So it's just some things to flag to be aware of. In terms of continuity of employment, you also need to think about and consider whether that's preserved. There are some particular rules when it comes to redundancy. So for example, if someone is made redundant, they're given notice of termination, or you come to an agreement, such as a settlement agreement, and you offer them, the situation changes and you offer them employment, and that offer is made before the actual termination of their employment. and they start that job, they are re-engaged within 4 weeks of the original termination date, then it's not classed as a dismissal for the purposes of statutory redundancy, and also continuity will be preserved. So it's something to consider in terms of your specific situation. There are also certain rules when it comes to if someone has brought an unfair dismissal complaint or the matter is being discussed through early ACAS conciliation. So those are just some things to consider. It's always going to be case specific, but it's not as a starting point. It's not something that's, you know, prohibited as a general position. So we still stop to through some things to think about there. That's all of our questions today. Thank you for joining us. Just a reminder, Sinton's continues to work hard to put up-to-date and relevant content on the website. There are podcasts, articles, all of the Q&A sessions, videos. They're all, you can find all of those on our website, www.sintons.co.uk. You can also find the employment team's Twitter feed at Sintons HR. If you'd like to discuss anything that's been covered in this session, or you have any other employment related or other legal queries, please do get in touch. Our contact details are on the slides. Our next session is going to be on the Friday, the 23rd of July, and we'll be sent details about that closer to the event. So please do send any questions you do have, and we'll make sure we look at those and cover them in the coming sessions. So that's all from us. I'd like to say thank you again for joining us, and take care.